To see everybody this morning. As you can see from the designator there on the bottom, we are going to have our third lesson now on the general topic of marriage and divorce and remarriage in the Old Testament and in the New. We're going to be looking at this in an overly comprehensive manner, maybe, but all springboarding off of 1 Corinthians chapter 7. So each week I'll put up some title slide that just has to do with Corinth itself to remind us that we really are talking about 1 Corinthians 7, though you won't see it for weeks to come. This is what's called the Acrocorinth. Those are medieval fortifications. The city itself would be completely out of sight, but just at the foot on the other side right there. So what we've seen in our first two lessons is that in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul has a six-point outline or six sections in the chapter. First, dealing with married saints, those that are both Christians. Those that are unmarried, which is a term we'll spend a lot of time thinking about, but at one point he has the unmarried contrasted with the widows, and then at another place, after he talks about those that are in a marriage where the mate is not a Christian, we have the virgins, which are also separated from the unmarried. So while widows and virgins are, of course, unmarried, there's also apparently somebody else that's not a widow or a virgin that fits into that category. We'll come back to that and work with that in some detail when the time comes. We then have the parents, I believe, in the last few verses. Some think it's the betrothed husband-to-be. And again, we'll talk about that in due time. But we found this. There are nine verses in that chapter that teach it is better to marry than to burn. And there are another 18 which teach that you should remain in the condition in which you were called or the current condition that you find yourself in. So what I've suggested is that Paul has two very bedrock qualities or characteristics or underpinnings for all of 1 Corinthians 7, which are, it's better to marry than to burn, and you should remain in your current condition. But there are two others that I added. We should be careful about forbidding marriage to anybody, because 1 Timothy describes that as a doctrine of demons, and we certainly don't want to get into the business of promoting divorces, because God hates divorce. Now, I want to make sure everybody understands, though, when I put these last two up, you know, I realized that all four of these might have exceptions. We haven't talked about any exceptions yet. I'm just saying, here are some thoughts that we have to at least play a role in our equation. And probably a pretty significant role. Those are very fundamental thoughts. And they're very prominent, 27 verses out of 40 in 1 Corinthians 7. And then a doctrine of demons ought to, you know, scare us, and does everybody, I'm sure. We don't want to be promoting divorces unless we have to, unless we have to, unless we have to, unless we have to. So for me, I'm just saying those are broad principles that may be exceptions, but we better find those exceptions and be sure about them. Now, Matthew 19, verses 3 through 12, is ultimately where all the problems lie. I think truly that's the source of all the problems. I think there's a wide range of identifying statements that are made there, various conditions and responsibilities and becauses, and we need to sort those all out, every one of them, perfectly well, or we're going to get derailed. So I suggested last week that twice, Matthew 19:4 and also in verse 8, you have this Greek expression, which means from the beginning. So for the first time in what is now, three times that I'm teaching on this material, 1998, 2008, now, with some 10 years in between, typically, I'm rearranging all my material. This is a very different presentation and more full than I've ever done before. So I highly recommend you get the 1998 recordings, get the 2008 recordings. They'll shed additional light and be helpful. But, you know, my purpose here was to do it differently than those. Those are on the record. Those are out there. I wouldn't change a word in any of them. But I just wanted to give this class more full and a kind of a different approach. So we went back to the beginning. When I get first things first, always before, I'm in 1 Corinthians 7 first. This time we're going to march our way chronologically through time, see what God's been doing all the way through. So last week we found there are a number of things that are somewhat surprising to us in our day and age that are presented as matters of fact. That is to say, with regard to sexual activity before Moses, is what we're thinking about last week and be thinking about again this morning. Prior to Moses, before Sinai, before that law came, there was sexual activity, there was marriage, there was divorce, there were additional marriages. People were doing the same things back then that they're doing now. And so what we saw was, in Genesis 4, verses 1 and 2, we have our very first instance of sexual activity. It's Adam and Eve. And they're going to have children because of it. But we noted that that's presented as a matter of fact. No judgment call is placed upon them. It just states it happened. We know that it's not wrong in any way, shape, or form. But the manner in which it was presented, I thought, was important. Because when we get to Genesis chapter 4, verses 16 and 17, we've got our first instance of incest, but it too is presented as a simple matter of fact. No judgment call is made. It's not declared to be right or wrong, but we see so much of it, I'm very convinced it's not wrong at that point. And if you've been in a Wednesday night class on Leviticus, you know incest is never condemned until Leviticus. I think there's a reason for that. I think it's up to that time that God is populating the earth. Abraham, you know, was married to his half-sister, which is expressly forbidden in Leviticus. But up to Moses' law, prior to Moses' law, sexual activity between Adam and Eve is not wrong. Incest is not wrong. In verse 19, polygamy is not wrong. And then, though, we find that in chapter 12, and again in chapter 20, Abraham tries to pull a wool over somebody's eyes. First in Egypt, and then the king of Gerar, Abimelech, down in the south. He tries to pass off his actual full-blown real deal. Yes, she is, and God isn't mad. Half-sister as only a sister that he's not married to. But she's his wife, and that's okay. Not a problem in the world for him to have his half-sister as his wife in God's sight. But it is wrong when you're coveting somebody else's wife and when you're wanting to take another man's wife for your own. So we found out that Abraham's trying to pull the wool over the Egyptian pharaoh didn't work. And it didn't work for Abimelech either. And in both cases, it's apparent, particularly in chapter 20, Abimelech's mad, and we're talking about sin, the words being used. So they understood back then that some things were okay and other things were not, but they had a moral code of some kind. We also had our first instance of rape in chapter 34. That's real wrong. And in that same chapter and in that same event, you have the first ever mention in Scripture of the word harlotry. It, too, is portrayed there as being wrong. So, Dinah's sisters are upset. Now, they should be. This is a little disorienting for us. We don't live all that long ago. But brethren, these are the facts. So they were just presented in a matter-of-fact manner up through the polygamy, and then they are wrong. People are complaining about it, feeling that violations are taking place. So what we're looking for today is to try and figure out what law were they under? By what standard were these judgments being made? How do they know rape is wrong, but polygamy is okay? How do they know back then harlotry is wrong, but we can still marry brothers and sisters? What law were they under at that time? Now, my personal apologies right off the bat here, because if you've been in our Wednesday night classes, as recently as 5 months ago on January 2nd, I presented the chart that I'm about to present now. I think in my whole history of chart making, which goes back about 30 years now, this may be the single most important chart I ever came up with. I'm going to expand upon it greatly. But for those of you that, you know, were there back in January, you know, get ready. You've seen these ideas before. So, brethren, before the beginning, if we think of the beginning as being creation, before there was physicality, before there was materiality, before God spoke into existence the universe, there's just eternity. There's nothing physical about God, and there's nothing physical anywhere. There's just the vastness and the incomprehensibility of God, a purely spirit being in eternity. And then something happened. Let there be. So God, in the course of 6 days, creates the physical universe. And when he does, he establishes certain laws. We saw, for instance, you know, in a recent class, we were talking about after their kind, after their kind, after their kind, after their kind. Those are the laws of nature. You can't plant corn and get rutabagas. Just doesn't happen. So God established physical laws for the universe. I'm going to be suggesting he also established moral laws as well, a universal moral law. Now, I've drawn these extra lines to show that we're just going to block off, you know, eternity on both ends. But time, the physical universe, now begins. And will be divided, I think, by the scriptures. Certainly the first period is identified very carefully. But time is going to be divided into three parts. From Adam to Moses, who lived in the most broadly general terms about 1500 BC, you have a first period of time that we'll see designated in the Roman letter in a few minutes. Then you have, after those 1500 years, the coming of Jesus the Christ, and that establishes a new time frame. We will wind up then with what's before Moses, what's from Moses to Christ, and then from what's Christ to the final judgment. Now, I don't know how many years there are before Moses. So I've got 3,000 years plus. That's going to be endlessly argued. You know, we just don't know. And so be happy with that or not. But, you know, there's some period of time. During Moses, there's 1,500 years, real close. That one we can nail down. And, of course, we know exactly how many years it's been since Jesus died on a cross. But we're still counting. So it's really not quite 2,000 yet, but we'll get there. You know, and so here we are. We're looking at three time frames. And note, please, that the longest one so far, at least, is all that time before Moses showed up and talked to God on Sinai. The shortest one, by at least half, is the law of Moses. And now we've had about 2,000 years. We're nearly 500 years longer than the time that Moses was around. And again, these are just facts. I'm not going to make anything out of them except just to note, you know, for whatever it's worth, that's curious. So far, we've had a lot more time before Moses than in any other period. Now, please open to Romans chapter 5. In Romans chapter 5 and verse 12, we're going to have this first period of time set forth for us. Romans 5, verse 12. Just as through one man, sin entered into the world, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned, for until the law, you'll notice in your Bible, probably like mine, L in law is capitalized. Every commentator who's ever lived, anybody who's ever thought they were a Christian, anybody who's ever read a Bible, we all agree. There's not one dissenting voice, I suppose, in all of history. That's Moses' law we're talking about. They put a capital L on it because we're talking about those 1,500 years. Until that law showed up, sin was in the world. But sin is not imputed when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam until Moses. Time frame one. Even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam, who is a type of him who was to come. So Adam sinned in a particular manner. But everybody was sinning, and they were sinning in different ways. There's I don't know how many different ways that you could violate God's will and be declared to be a sinner, which carries the death penalty, an eternal one, for all the people that live before Moses. God has not delivered any written law, but there is law. The point of Romans 5, 12 through 14 is that you cannot have sin or death unless you have a law. That law, whatever it was, absolutely everybody was under. And there were eternal consequences as well as physical consequences if you violated it. There was some law. This is the whole argument that we've got here in these verses. There was law before Moses, and don't you Jews think differently. There was law before Moses, and Adam then, Noah, Abraham, the patriarchs, they were all under that law, whatever it is. So that's probably a little bit too small. I've got to try to cram a lot out of the screen. But I've got Adam, Noah, Abraham, patriarchs. They're all being judged by this law, that law. There is no Moses. Then we have Moses, Samuel, Judges, and the Jews. They're in a separate time frame then. Matthew 5, 12 through 4, or Romans rather, 5, 12 through 14. You know, now we go to the next time frame. Now please get this. I think it's easily forgotten. I've seen it forgotten a lot. The Old Testament law was not for everybody. You've never been under it, nor has anybody been under it for the last 2,000 years. Moses' law went away. But Moses' law, when it went away, it didn't go away for the Gentiles because they were never under it. It went away for the Jews, only for the Jews. For this smallest period of time in world history, 1,500 years, in an extremely tiny geographical location, which I'm sure I personally could walk end to end of the whole thing in about 3 weeks. I did 50 miles back in 2011 and ran an average of 10 miles a day. If I do 10 miles a day in Israel, it takes 2.5 weeks to walk through the whole land. And that's the only place where that law was in effect. And they were the only people for whom it was in effect. They had the law. Nobody else did. Nobody else was held accountable for it for a very tiny period of time in a very specific and tiny location for one racial group alone. There was Moses' law. Nobody else was under it. Never forget that in all your equations. Then we come to our third time frame, obviously, from Christ, the end of time. After Moses, then, we've got the apostles, we've got Christians, we've got Jew and Gentile. Now, there's this New Testament law that applies to saints. Certainly, we're under that law, not this law anymore. Question is whether or not we're under that one. That's what we're going to be developing. But here, this New Testament law is for the saints. Now, let me point something out. It'll be very big as we continue developing this. Please note, you are not a sinner because you weren't a Christian. Becoming a Christian fixes sin, does away with sin, forgives sin, expunges sin, atones for sin. But you already had the sin. Somehow, you became a sinner all over the surface of the earth, whether you've ever read the four Gospels or any other of the 27 books of the New Testament. That's another thing people tend to forget. You're not a sinner and destined for destruction because you haven't been baptized. You're a sinner because you've committed some violation of some law somewhere, whether you've read a Bible ever or not. And then you have to come to Christ, and only to Christ, to get those sins fixed. These are very, very important things to remember. Now, back up a couple of chapters in Romans. We're going to go to chapter 1, verses 20 and 21. Then we're going to skip to 28 through 32. Now, watch this. This is another thing that just has enormous, you know, prominence in all of my thinking when it comes to sexual activity, marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And, in fact, how anybody becomes a sinner. There's laws along these lines that this chapter 1 is going to help us out with. Now, chapter 1, let's start verses 20 and 21. Since the creation of the world, stop. Since when? Since the 6 days of creation. Since then, His invisible attributes, God's invisible attributes, something about His character, something about His personality, something about the way He thinks, something about what we would call virtue, for He has no sin. But brethren, since the creation, God's invisible attributes and His eternal power and His divine nature. This week I did a big study for myself on that word nature. Found it endlessly fascinating. I might, give you some of the fruits and notes and stuff, you know, on that study. But this is an endlessly important word. We may come back to it. And matter of fact, when we get further along in these studies, I'm not sure yet. But look, God has a nature. God has a core being, and that which is inherent in godliness, or in godness is a better way to put it, that's His nature. Now, since the creation, brethren, invisible attributes, power, and the nature of God have been clearly seen, is the next statement. Now, you can't see anything that's invisible. But you can understand it, you can interact with it, you can flip that switch on that invisible electricity and make all these lights come on. You're probably all of you hoping it'll go away as soon as we get done filming this class. Blinding in here right now for the sake of the camera. But brethren, you can see things with your mind's eye. You can understand these things. The invisible attributes and the divine nature, as well as the power of God, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. And that is every living, breathing human being that's ever been on the surface of the planet. So it's comprehensive. It's all-inclusive. Now, I should, you know, just think about this just a tiny bit more here, brethren. Understood through what has been made. I think my own thinking was far too limited for probably 2 or 3 decades. And really, I think all I was really getting out of this verse was, you can know there is a God by seeing all the evidence in physical creation. I wasn't, I think, properly understanding these invisible attributes are also understood. His divine nature is also understood. Invisible things about God are understood, as well as that He exists when you're living in the physical universe. And these things are so clearly seen that no human being has any excuse. So they must be pretty clearly seen. Pretty clearly seen indeed. 21. I'm sorry, somebody had a hand up.
May I ask one question?
Sure.
We started off in Genesis, but just by this call, she leaves father and mother, and they shall cling to his wife, and they shall become one flesh.
Mm-hmm.
Who joined them?
I think you're the third person this week to ask me that question. Who performed the wedding ceremony in Genesis? Now, what God has joined together, God joined them together. Or do we read about it anywhere? You know, how He did it? Was there a ceremony? Did they have a little arbor? You know,
I don't think He needed ceremony. God joined them.
Yeah.
We have a marriage, and it could even, I'm sure that happened all the way through that there were.
You're absolutely correct, and that's what I'm getting to. Brethren, let's just say it right now. Men and women, in this time frame, now they're just totally different creatures in every way than we are, right? Adam wasn't like us at all. We live so much later, we're very different than him, huh? No, there's nothing new under the sun. I experience everything Adam has. I'm in the flesh like Adam is. See, were people marrying back then? Yeah. Then came the law of Moses, and that's when God changed everybody and made them into different kinds of people, so they need a new law. No, certainly not. We're still the same. There's nothing new under the sun. That also has had a lot of influence in my thinking. Men and women haven't changed since the beginning. Marriage and divorce then has been going on since the beginning. Nothing's changed in the physical relationships. Don't we all have the same marital problems and stresses and strains that they had back here and over here? Everybody's going through the same stuff. Yeah.
If God joins them, who unjoins them?
We'll come to that when we get to Matthew 19.
Well, I know that.
God says in Matthew 19, let no man do that. So man does it, and that's why he's forbidden to do it. God never forbids what you can't do. So the answer is man, and you shouldn't. But God also did some divorcing.
He overrules God, man does.
No, God gave law on divorce, and man plays a role in it. Okay, but wait for Matthew 19. Now look, at this point I know how hard this is. I know I'm really teasing you. Where's the battlefield? Where's all the blood been shed? Where were all the churches split? Where were all the divorces forced? Where were all people told they couldn't marry again the rest of their lives? All because of only one verse. Matthew 19. All of that devastation stems from one passage of Scripture, which I believe has been thoroughly misunderstood, or we wouldn't have had all that disaster. So that's why I'm trying to lay the groundwork to make sure we know what we're talking about before we come to the terms that Jesus uses in Matthew 19. Because if we don't use the terms of Matthew 19 the way the Bible always has, then we're going to make some real serious mistakes. So I'm teasing you, and it's hard. I know you guys, it's just hard.
If you take only one passage, verse, scripture, and be relevant, like you said, it's thoroughly misunderstood.
Okay. So stick with me. And let me say for the first time, too, please start writing down all of your questions. And by that I especially mean, please write down all your objections. Now, I've held the view I've got right now for 21 years. I think I've heard most of those objections, and I think I'll show you where the verses are that show it's really no objection to my view at all. A view you don't even know what it is yet, because I'm trying to understand God's view first before I even tell you what I think mine is now. So, you know, we'll get to all that. But I'm hoping to have a last class or two or three or ten, depending on how long your lists are, you know, where you get your time to say, well, I don't believe it, you're wrong, and here's why. Those will be the fun classes. We'll see. Okay. But truly, I want your feedback. I really do. But as I said in the first two classes, hear me out first. Understand what I'm saying before you tell me I'm wrong. Now, I know in a group this size, some of you are not going to agree with me. That's great with me. I think that's fine. I disagreed with me for 23 years, and then I changed my mind now. So that's okay. You know, we're all in this together. But let me just present my case, and then you'll have your time. We'll see how it works out. But what I'm hoping, and what's been the case in previous times, is that, you know, if we'll build this properly, your questions will all be answered by the time we get to Matthew 19. Matthew 19 won't be nearly so hard if we get God's background on it before we just say, hey, boom, go to Matthew 19 and here's where I stand. That's been the big mistake, I think, in all of our work. So, I don't think I finished that last one, everybody. Please, back to Romans now, chapter 1. We read verses 20 and 21. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes and his nature are clearly seen. Skip to 28. And just as they, that's all those people back before Moses, first time frame, just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer. I circled any longer. They were acknowledging God. They had no excuse to disacknowledge God, if there is such a word. But they were, and then they quit. They wouldn't do it any longer. God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness. There was a law against unrighteousness before Moses' law. Wickedness existed before Moses. Greed existed. Evil existed. Full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. But Brethren 32 says they knew those things were wrong. They know the ordinance of God. The ordinance of God, the rules, the statutes, the laws, were known before Moses. There was a death penalty attached, and nobody has an excuse because the nature of God is known by your experience in living in this world. So, though 32, they knew not the ordinance of God, although they know the ordinance of God, those who practice such things are worthy of death. They not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. So, wrong, wrong, wrong. Now, in chapter 2, come to chapter 2, we're going to look at verses 11 through 16. 2:11, there is no partiality with God. We're going to think about that in my last slide a bit. Really? And what does that mean? So how many different laws are there where God is partial to one people, lets them have an easier law than he does with other people who must endure harsher laws? God is not partial, is he? No, he isn't. Now watch 12. All who have sinned without law. All these people in time frame 1. Never met Moses, never heard of Moses. They lived before he was born. There's no law in Sinai. Those people, brethren, are the ones we're thinking about now. They sinned, Romans 5, without Moses' law. And they'll also perish without Moses' law. Then he says, all who sinned under the law, Moses' law, will be judged by the law. For not the hearers of the law. Every time the word law is used in this passage, it's Moses' law and no other law. Moses' law. The hearers of Moses' law are not just before God, but the doers of the law will be justified. Oh, okay, well, great. Then everybody that's not a Jew for 1,500 years in Israel doesn't have any law at all, right? No, there's 14. There's 14, brethren. I believe it's long gone time we started dealing with 14. When Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively, in the New American Standard, by nature, that's why I got caught up in all that study of the word nature. Instinctively, by nature, when Gentiles do the things of the law, these, not having the law, are a law unto themselves. And they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them on the day when, according to my gospel, God will judge the secrets of men through Jesus Christ. And that's clear back here at the end. Really? So, what do we got here, brethren? We have sin and death before Moses. We have sin and death during Moses for those very few people in that little time, in that small place that were under Moses' law, and you and I never were. And then we got sin now. We got sin all the way through. And it's got something to do with the fact that every human being knows the nature of God. They know his invisible attributes. They know right from wrong. And those Gentiles back there never heard of Moses' law, never had anything to do with Moses' law. They could do instinctively what was in it. They could do by nature what was in it. Now be very careful, brethren, as you think about this. I once asked a Seventh-day Adventist preacher just a couple of years ago, do you think that anybody could do instinctively, I think of this passage, I said, do you think there's anybody who would know instinctively that they ought to not work on Saturdays? Took him a while before he could utter the words. Finally admitted it. He was an honest man. He got him a lot of respect for her in the local congregation here in town. He said, no, I don't think he could. And he's right. The things that you can do by nature, the things that you can do instinctively, the law you must keep lest you become a sinner who must die, that gives you the invisible attributes of God and tells you about His nature, that law, brethren, hasn't got anything to do with building temples in Jerusalem. Hasn't got anything to do with the Sabbath. Read the bulletin article this morning. I've been saving it for 6 weeks just for today. There's a reason for it. Let's go read that article in the bulletin this morning. But let me finish this class right now because I'm running out of time. Here's what I'm driving at. Brethren, there was always a universal moral law. You didn't always have to build temples. You didn't always have to slaughter goats. You didn't always have to do anything that had to do with the Levitical priesthood. Very tiny group of people in a very small place for a really small period of time had to do those things. Those things are not moral. Those things are not a part of the invisible attributes and divine nature of God. Those things didn't exist back in eternity, but godness did. And in Him there is no darkness. And when you are made in the image of God, then you share the image of God, and you only live and breathe and in Him have your very being, because He has endowed you with His Spirit. And therefore, something of His nature, which you can understand instinctively because it's a part of your nature now. All human beings know it's wrong to lie, and you don't need a law from Moses to figure that out. That's why Abimelech's so upset with Abram. That's why Pharaoh was mad at him. There are some things, brethren, that judge all people whether they ever read a Bible. And it is because they violated this law that has existed since creation and brought sin and death into the world. It's because of that law that you now need Christ. You've already sinned by that law. Now, let's develop this a little more thoroughly. Let's back up here just a bit and think about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. That's a law. Is it like building temples? Is it like killing goats? Is it linked to feast days at a certain time of the year when you have a harvest? Like was in the ceremonial parts of Moses' law? Before Moses, were there laws on marriage, divorce, and remarriage that you could know by nature, that you could do instinctively? Of course. We didn't have a written law. Nobody did. So there's law number one on marriage and divorce. Starts back in the beginning, comes forward with Adam and Eve. People have been doing it all along, every part of the planet, whether they've ever read a Bible or not. That's law number one. Now, the big question that everybody thinks they find in Matthew 19 is that the Jews will suddenly not be under that law. They're going to be given a second law instead, a different law. And they think they find in Matthew 19 that this second law is lower. That God looked down and said, oh, look at those people. You know, they really don't want to serve me, so okay, I won't make them. I'm going to let them have what they want. So for the Jews, grudgingly, I just suffer it to be done, but I don't like it. And the Gentiles over here, you know, we never did it before. But these Jews, they don't want to serve me. So I'm going to go ahead and let them have a different law, and they can go ahead and cast off their wives for whatever reason they want. I put that in yellow because that was my view for 23 years. I got that wrongly out of Matthew 19. I just missed the boat on Matthew 19 altogether, but I thought that's what he was saying. So now there was, I thought, a second law, different than the first law, and what is very important, the Gentiles were left under the first law, because they didn't get Moses' law. We just read all that. So the Jews got a second law of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. It was easier and meant you could divorce your wives more easily. But the Gentiles were still held to the higher standard. They didn't get that pass because they never got Moses' law. That's what I was thinking. Now, it comes Christianity. Well, is it the same law as the first law? Is it the same as the second law? Is it a third law? How often does God change his mind on marriage, divorce, and remarriage? And to what people does he allow free and easy divorce as opposed to those who have to hold, you know, to the standard from the first law? These are really important questions. Now, I'm going to go along today. I got to. Okay, now we're going to change things. I wiped out, it's exactly the same chart. I just took a lot of it away. And now I want to do this for a minute. I'm going to pull Moses over here to the right. See the green arrows? I'm pulling Moses over to the right. And what am I going to do, though? I'm leaving that center, you know, divider. Because here's Abraham in 1900 B.C. He's about 400 years before Moses, rough terms again. But there's a 400-year gap between those two. Now, I just want to think from Adam to Moses, what was going on? Because, brethren, Adam and Noah and the rest of those guys prior to Abraham, before Abraham, then after Abraham, there used to be no Jew-Gentile distinction at all. There's just people. Everybody. All people. All the whole earth. Under a law they could do by nature. After Abraham, you have Jews and Gentiles, and never the twain shall meet. So here's a question for you. Before Abraham, when we start getting Jews, and for the 400 years then after Abraham, where we have Jews but no Moses, were the people before Abraham under that first marriage law, but now that we've got Jews, is that where God changed it and said, okay, you Jews don't want to serve me, fine, right here, now that Abraham's here, I'm going to lower the standard. You guys can divorce your wives for any cause at all. Is that where the law changed? I didn't know. I thought it did change, but I didn't know if it changed when God brought Jews into the world or only when Sinai came. Were all people still under the first marriage law after Abraham but before Moses? Were only, you know, the Jews under this second law then, or were they still under the first? Did the Gentiles get, you know, a third law, a different law altogether when God made Jews? I had a real firm position, thought I could tell people they'd have to spend the rest of their lives in celibacy, and I'd never answered any of those questions. It began to bother me a lot. So here's this universal moral law that Paul's been telling us about in a Roman letter, spanning all of that time. Was there a first marriage, divorce, and remarriage law up to Abraham, and then everybody still under it to Moses? Or was there a second law that was given when we became Jews? You know, the Jews alone were born through Abraham, but not until Moses. Did they get a third law, is what we just carried forward from the last chart. But now from Moses to Christ, I thought the Jews got a second law, an easier law, divorce your wives for any cause at all. That leaves the Gentiles under the higher standard, and they don't even have a written law. How fair is that? Here God takes the Jews apart to send them all kinds of prophets, gives them a written law, expands magnificently on all of these things, leaves the Gentiles without any of it, and holds them to a higher standard than he does the Jews, because they can divorce their wives for any cause at all. But the Gentiles are still under the first. It's bothering me a lot now. Now come the Christians. First law? Are the lost under the first law still? Or are the lost under some other law now? So here's what I've come up with. As you add up all these various laws, brethren, I can figure out a possibility of 7 different marriage, divorce, and remarriage laws, depending on who you are and when you live before these various people. And none of those answers are found in your Bible. What verses, this is my challenge for the class now, for this next week. What verses in the Old Testament say that any marriage law was ever changed? Now, I thought Matthew 19 was the one place in all the Bible that said marriage law changed, and for the Jews only, they could divorce their wives for any cause at all. Then I got to wondering, well, when did God ever tell the Jews that? So you search your Old Testament from stem to stern. Were they ever told that they were under a different marriage law and now they can cast off their wives where before they couldn't and the Gentiles still can't? I can't find it. I'd really like to, because I believed that for 23 years. But now I realize I can't find any place in the Old Testament that teaches that.
I don't think it's there.
Then we've got, what verses in the Old Testament say that any moral law ever changed? Was lying okay for a while and then it wasn't? Was murder okay for a while and then it wasn't, and then you got to go back to the first standard again? Where does that ever happen? So here's my last chart. I know I ran over, but here we go. Brethren, in Acts 10:34 it says, I most certainly understand now that God is not one to show partiality. Unless you're a Jew, then you can divorce your wives for any cause at all. In Romans 2:11 it says, there is no partiality with God unless you're a Jew, and then you got a lower standard. Ephesians 6:9 says, both their master and yours is in heaven. And there's no partiality with him unless you're a Jew. And of course, you know, marriage, divorce laws are lower for you than they are for everybody else. How about Colossians 3:25? He who does wrong will receive the consequences of the wrong which he's done, and that without partiality, unless, of course, we all understand you're a Jew. 1 Peter 1. If you address as Father the one who impartially judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves in fear. Unless you're a Jew, then you're under a lower standard. But that standard went away too, didn't it? So, these are questions that have bothered me just a whole lot. Where I'm at, brethren, is that there is a universal, instinctive, natural law that people know. You should not make a promise and then not keep it. That's called a covenant. And that law, I'll get to you in just a second, Carol. That law has to do with moral laws and not building temples and killing goats. Go ahead.
So, Adam and Eve knew instinctively that they should not eat of the tree in the midst of the garden.
Well, I don't think so, because we have a statement that says that God told them that.
Yeah. They had to be taught that.
Well, I know they were taught that. And
they had to be taught that, or else they instinctively knew. So, it either has to be one way or the other.
Well, yeah, no, I'm not so sure, because God never said, you know, that you already knew this law, but I'm going to tell you about it anyway.
God said that he told them.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and I tell people laws all day long, you know, that they already know. I did this morning.
So,
but it's not fundamental to my point.
But it's fundamental to my point.
Okay, then make the list and we'll address it later. But whether or not Adam and Eve knew instinctively that they could not eat... what was your question again about the forbidden tree, right? Okay, could they know instinctively that? I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. I'm not saying God revealed every conceivable thing there is.
But you did say...
Instinctively. I said there are certain moral laws that all human beings can know. And I've also said, I think emphatically, what happened in the garden will never happen to us. We never lived in the garden. Nobody else ever did. The laws I'm talking about from the beginning are the ones that human beings have been in after sin.
So, people instinctively knew that, as you used in your illustration, that it was wrong to steal.
Oh, sure.
Instinctively.
Oh, absolutely. You find those laws everywhere. And the reason for that is because we don't like our stuff being taken.
If I had a baby today, and I didn't teach it not to steal, and it grew up, that it would instinctively know that it was wrong to steal.
Okay, if this is not so, what I'm teaching, then there is no law, and therefore no sin.
There is a law, and what you've said is true. God's law from the beginning, and that's what he tells us.
Okay, so your point...
In the beginning, when he's talking about marriage and divorce, he says, in the beginning, it was not so.
We'll get to Matthew 19. We'll get to Matthew 19, and we're going to analyze every one of those phrases, and I will show you grammatically from the Greek. I told you the Greek scholars I talked to how I had to change that view. I believed that all my life. I don't anymore, but that's because I then got involved after this. Now, trust me, brethren, if you want to take everything I've said in the last 3 weeks and throw it away and pretend it doesn't exist, okay, like most people do when they approach Matthew 19, I will still show you in Matthew 19. It was never so that God said, okay, if you don't want to serve me, then go ahead and divorce your wives. I'll let you do it for 1,500 years. He never did that. Okay? So we'll come back. Stick with me. As I've always said, understand me first, then accept or reject. Accept or reject. Accept or reject.